Hi, I'm Tony Mala, and welcome to the ASA Podcast, a program for automotive professionals that helps keep you ahead of what's now, what's new, and what's next in the business of automotive service and collision repair. This podcast is brought to you by the Automotive Service Association, dedicated to driving your success. And we'll be sharing information, insight, and inspiration that will not just help you make a living, it will help you make a difference. Hi, I'm talking today with Clark Pluchinski, the outgoing executive director of the Collision Repair Education Foundation, and a good friend. Clark, nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Tony.
I understand you have retired. Are you retired, or is this just you're just stepping back from this CREF?
Well, I guess I just had my first grandchild, or we just had our first grandchild.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, it was, people warned me that once that occurred, it would change our lives. And it certainly has, especially during these trying times that we're in, as far as being able to see the babies and do the things that we want to do with that grandchild. So, but after 53 years, I think it's probably time to get a little more serious about the word. I wouldn't call it retirement. I'd like to reinvent that and call that which we do afterwards just another chapter in our book of life's ventures.
Yeah, I hear you. But you've been around the industry, as you said, for quite some time. Tell me a little bit about your career. What have you done up until now?
So, you know, it's funny. I was in college at the time and had been a technician for a number of years, been in the Navy as a reservist on active duty for about a year and a half. After we got off of active duty, I went right back to work for a dealership I was working for, starting in the parts department, interestingly enough. Driving a truck, then on the parts counter, and they moved me over to the body shop counter. And one of the techs there asked me if I'd be interested in an apprenticeship. And I thought, how much? First thing in my mind. And he said, well, I'll pay you minimum wage. I said, for goodness sake, I'm making quite a bit of money in the parts department here. Why would I ever want to do that? And he reached in his top pocket and pulled out his check. And I leaned over and saw his check, and I said, wow, when can I start? So I started out, you know, 6 years or so as a technician, and I'd gone back to school. And in that period of time, I opened a little shop to kind of help me through the, you know, the trying times of being married, owning a shop, and being back in school all at once. And that 900 square feet in Beltsville next to Sandy John, which was the greatest part of it all, morphed into 7,200 feet there. And then, of course, 43 stores later in True to Form Collision Repair. So it's, you know, all along the way, I think, Tony, the thing that really, to me, was the most important, looking back over my shoulder and thinking, you know, how did you get where you are today? It was really the involvement with the industry, getting out, getting involved, being involved with ASA, ASE, all of the those alphabetic letters that we have to deal with, trying to figure out. But CAPA was important to us early on, where we got involved. I was blessed to be close to Jack Gillis and the work he did with CAPA, being the consumer advocate, being his neighbor, really, here in the D.C. market, learning from Jack and Sheila Loftus at the Hammer and Dolly, being president of the Hammer and Dolly, and then morphing into the national level and writing articles for a number of years. All the things that I used to hate to do, suddenly I found myself completely transformed as a result of the relationships I built, the network that was around me. And it made the transition from 4 stores in the DC market to our total of 43 when we sold True to Form much, much easier. Because I did know people and I did understand things at a different level. iCars board. I think, Tony, there was one time when I did the math, I was on 20 different committees. Chuck Sukla said to me, I want you to be on the NABC board. And I said, I can't do it, Chuck. And he goes, I really want you to do this. And I said, I really can't do this, man. So about 6 months went by and he said, next board meeting is this Saturday down in Florida, wherever we were all heading. And he said, you need to be at that meeting. So I attended the meeting. 6 months later, he fired me saying, you're not attending the meetings. You're not making the calls. I said, I'm telling you, man, I'm just too busy. But, you know, when I looked at those committee involvements, the work we did to try to, I think, help evolve the industry, understanding of the consolidation, starting with that 900 square feet and ending up damn close to 100 million in sales with 700 employees, that's a pretty decent journey. And here's what's interesting, at least this was to me, is the whole issue of the work when I was asked to participate with the foundation. I had been chairman of the foundation for a number of years and was probably the primary fundraiser for the foundation for CREF, which at that time was the ICAR Education Foundation. Mm-hmm. I think what I found the most rewarding to me in my entire career was to get in and start to work with the schools, the students, the instructors, the administration, and do what we used to do was to sell curriculum with CREF. And it was really, that was, it never seemed to fit. Is why are we selling curriculum when ICAR is building it and delivering it to the industry? Why are we selling the curriculum? So when we decided to become a philanthropic organization, I'm not even sure I knew what the hell that word meant at the time, that we decided to become far more philanthropic, we had to come up with a plan. And since I had been the chief fundraiser, I kind of continued down that path. So we grew it from probably 300,000 in total back when I took over as the executive director. Let me think back when that was. It was about 2012. I agreed to 2 years, and 8 years later here, we've moved to the last 3 or 4 years, we've been at 15 million a year that wow. We've been gifting back to the kids and their schools. But more importantly, really focusing on building the bridge to employment, if you would, a true bridge to employment. Mm-hmm. So next step, in order to get there, it's going to take more time than I'm able to give back to this organization, and it's time to do something different. So retirement, I don't know. I'm not sure what that means. So,
well, you have certainly been involved at all levels for as long as you and I have known each other, which is probably longer than either one of us care to admit.
Yes.
But you have been a force in the industry for change, and you're definitely going to be tough to replace. The fact that you're stepping back, what is a Collision Repair Education Foundation organization going to look like?
I think, in truth, post-Clark, I believe we will probably be more inclined to look at and really focus in on this thing we're calling the bridge to employment. So mm-hmm. In order to do that, I think we have to take a fresh look. We need a clean sheet of paper. The first issue was to figure out how to, so here's what we're working on. We're working on the attraction component. We need more and better people in the industry. Mm-hmm. We've always worked on supporting the schools, but that's changed over the years where it used to be help them with curriculum. And also, by the way, in those days, if you remember CRIN, where we worked on the Collision Industry Network.
Sure.
That was really important. And Melissa Marson, who's my right arm, and Brandon Eckenrode, that is the same. The two of those have worked so hard and so diligently on getting the schools involved. But that was important. But now it's like, okay, well, how do you take us? If you look at the commotion around the work at CIC today, their education committee, all those different fragmented, I don't want to use the term splintered because everybody's doing it for the right reason. But as we focused on it and we put, you know, 60, 70 hours a week in it, and that's all. At one point before the pandemic, we were at 7 folks really focused in on building this new direction for us. I have found that it's too hard to identify right now what that's going to look like as far as the organization structure goes. So we are in the middle, as we speak, of building the plan, but with the caveat, you can't really build a plan if someone else is coming in until we figure out who that person is, what that person has in the way of resources, either around them or they own themselves. Mm-hmm. What is it that they can do? Until we get all that sorted out, it'll be a little bit tough. So I would think, and I believe the board's plan is to keep me around at some level to kind of help out through the transitional piece to make sure that this next stage that we actually get into and get through. And I really do believe it's going to take help and support from ICAR and their 200 committees and their 2,000 volunteers to really help us to be able to take and localize it. So, you know, we've done a pretty good job of the national footprint, 20 plus career fairs a year, all the golf outings, all the stuff that they're doing committee-wise for us today, where those dollars get raised by the local committees and they get pushed right back into their schools. But with the, again, with the help and support of CREF, where we don't just give money away, we look at some return on that investment today. And that really is critical. We didn't do real well with that in the old days. So we used to give a lot of money away, but we didn't actually have any accountability around that. Today, there's a criteria that we built. And Tony, you remember this when you were with ASE, is we worked on a criteria that at some level was being questioned as if were we competing with some of the other organizations that were out there. But you can remember when we were there with Skills and ASE and ourselves, and we really did sit down and say, hey, I think it's important, Clark thinks it's important, that if we're going to support a school, that they're involved with ASE, that they understand the criteria, that they understand the tools that which they that the student should be learning, that they understand that there needs to be a pre-employment path or direction with AES, that, you know, all of the stuff that's around these organizations, how do you take the best of that and actually have that culminate into something special, which is full employment? And not just employment, but the whole issue around retention, where we can't blow that poor student up once they transition into that business. And that's really been our big challenge today. As much as I put the blame on us on the CREF level of not having the criteria in place, which we now have, not having maybe the right, it's one thing to have the curriculum, which they do have because of ICAR today, but how are they using that curriculum? What are they learning from that curriculum? If we're going to give a school $50,000 or more in a year's time, what is it that we expect from that school? And are they committed to helping us get there? And if we didn't have that, we probably shouldn't be supporting that school. So when I look at that transformation that's occurred over the last 3 or 4 years since we've been working on this overall plan, it's really come to a point now where we need the businesses to be more accountable to the individuals coming in. And we need a lot of focus around when we give them something, whatever it is, a spray booth, a welder, a group, you know, in some cases we rebuilt their IT departments for them, whatever it is. I mean, we had schools that had the curriculum, but they didn't have the IT structure to use the curriculum as an example, you know, or a welder and they didn't have three-phase electricity to be able to use the welder, or they never bothered to learn how to, because, you know, the problem with giving them something, it's not like a shop where something's sold to the shop and then you've got the rep coming in and the training and all that support behind it. Once we receive the welder, what happens next? Well, usually nothing happened because that rep was not selling it at the same level as they would, or the company. In many cases, it came directly from the companies that supported us. ProSpot would send 12 welders a year. They distributed to the schools that we had chosen based off of their grant request, the school's grant. And then that request came, okay, you want a welder, what are you going to do with it? And how will you use that? And what will be the outcome of that? And by the way, if you don't have a local committee supporting that, where you've got someone with feet on the street, and that's what our committees represent, we probably weren't going to get there. You know, today we're getting there, but it's been a little more of a challenge to figure out how to pull all that together. And especially now that we only have three of us again because of COVID. So even with seven, it was damn close to impossible to get to the point that we could really hold the accountability at the level that we want. But I will tell you, with a true partnership with ICAR, which we've always had, I mean, we are the ICAR Education Foundation. We're doing business as the Collision Repair Education Foundation. there's still linkage there. But I think we're kind of morphing into a time where we need more of that commitment than we probably had in the past. And by the way, I'm not sure we needed it in the past, because we went from really putting curriculum in schools to raising money. What I think that the board missed when we made this transition years ago is we didn't realize that money without accountability is just a nice thing to do. Mm-hmm. Today, we're trying to do nice things, but with a outcome that's predictable.
Well, the Collision Repair Education Foundation has certainly had an impact on the industry. How many schools would you estimate that you've helped over the years?
When I was chairman of the organization in 2007, somewhere 2007 or 8, somewhere in there, we had 1,454 schools.
Wow.
And we were working with 900 of those schools. Today, that number has dropped to 1,000. And if we were to do the math at the end of 2020 with what we're just going through, it's probably fallen well below the 1,000 mark today. Out of that 1,000, we were supporting and are supporting 700 of those schools. What's a little confusing is out of those 700 schools, because of the criteria we built, 200 of those schools, I'm rounding it off here, but 200 of those schools receive a much higher level of support from us because of the criteria. Hmm. Our deal was to grow them in from a tier 3 status to a tier 1 status, which was all of the, you know, the 15 or 20 things we have on their list that they needed to accomplish. It took them time to get there. So we funded those steps. Mm-hmm. That was our goal. Now, if 3M tomorrow decided to give us 10 tractor trailer loads of materials, which we would absolutely love, we would work through the logistics of that and try to put that material, that gift, in the right schools that would produce the right result. So our top 200 of that 1,000, our 20%, would receive the primary focus. And what was left over would go to the other 500 schools. Mm-hmm. So, or, you know, somewhere in that line, we would draw the line, if you would, and try to really focus in on. That's what's allowed us to really start to move towards the whole focus of employment, is now that we've got the schools, we've got the criteria laid out, the plan's being drawn up as we speak, but I would say 20 to 30 of those schools are the ones that we will really, really hone in on, mm-hmm. to try to come up with measurable results that we're looking for now. So, you know, and again, then it gets very technical. We started out probably 2 or 3 years ago. Russell Thrall and I worked on building a program that was similar to AES. Mm-hmm. The difference is that we were working and focusing more on what happened at the shop level once the student transitioned into the shop. And again, what confuses most is I believe the transition, and a lot of people agree with me, but there's a lot that don't, that the transition needs to occur while they're in school, so that there is a partnership between the school and the business. And the business itself has to have the technician, the ownership, whatever it is, whatever the structure is, but that group that's producing these repairs needs to accountable to the school, and the school needs to be accountable to that business. And we are, I'll call us the referee there. Mm-hmm. We're working towards making sure. So we felt like we could work with 20 schools. 2 years ago, we had a list of 6 schools that we were piloting. Unfortunately, that is now going through a different organization, which, you know, I'm not sure that's a bad thing, because we really weren't in the position to have the resources around us to get to where we were trying to go. Mm-hmm. But what we did is we understood what outcome we were looking for. And now I think we've got a chance with the right business plan in place and the right support behind us and some help from ICAR to ultimately get there. It's all a little bit cloudy, but there's more clarity around this. And, you know, our dear friend, Mr. Rick Turry, he used to tell me there's not a damn soul that knows what you're doing other than you. Mm. And that's always a little tough. And I said, you know, the problem is I don't know what I'm doing, but I know we've got to do something different. And in that doing something different, that will evolve into a clear vision of the future. And I think that's kind of where we are today. We did a lot of stuff, and some of it worked, some of it didn't. And people get tired of hearing me say this, but Edison didn't invent the light bulb the first time he turned the switch on, you know?
Yeah.
He put a lot of damn glass in the process. So I feel like we're doing a little bit of the same. And I will say that I was really encouraged, but I want to wait another 2 or 3 years while we're getting through with the mess we're in today. And, you know, and I think, again, I can be outside helping where I'm needed as I'm needed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know if they will need me, but it all depends upon who they pick to succeed me. And I've got a very good staff that's very dedicated, and I know they'll be intimately involved in that next stage of our development. So I did my bit, and I tell you, as I said earlier, I've never done anything, all the committees, all the boards, everything I've done, all those articles I wrote, never felt more fulfilled than I have over the last 6 years or so working with the foundation. So I was blessed to be asked, and I thought, you know, when you don't need something is when it usually comes to you.
Well, your work with the foundation has certainly been noteworthy and commendable. Have you gotten the support you think you needed from the shops in the industry? Everybody talks about needing technicians, but it's that getting involved with advisory councils and things like that to really help the process along. Do you feel that the shops need to be more involved going forward?
I think, you know, Rex Dunn used to say this to me all the time. He used to say, "Clark, I don't get it. What are you trying to tell me?" And I think I'm laying it out perfectly. And he'd say, "I don't get it." It's like, "You drive me crazy, Rex." But I realize that very few people, as Turi said, really get me. So what I would tell you is that I know well that the shops are not ready because they really don't know how to do this. And even the larger organizations, they have the infrastructure, but they don't necessarily have the wherewithal to figure out how to transition that student. And part of it's because, you know, I likened it to the golf swing. We teach them something in school, but it's a little bit of everything. And then there is an actual expectation that they come out of that school with full knowledge of what to do next. They have no clue what to do next. And then dump them into our competitive environment where you have technicians that are on commission that have never been formally trained on how to mentor someone and ask them to take that next step for us.
Mm.
Too much luck is involved at that level. It's way too arbitrary, and we need that plan. And that's really what I've been speaking to during this discussion is the ability now to kind of lock that down, that pilot we were working on, and the accountability with the shop. I had a nice list of to-dos for the shop that with the right help, with the right organization. And again, I go back to ICAR. They've got 6 regional folks and they're working with us with the schools. They're holding their committees accountable to working with the schools, even raising money for us with the schools in their local markets.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, most people don't know this, but ICAR has got, I believe it's like 300 fixed sites now that they're teaching out of, that they're doing their welding certifications out of. But those schools need to be retrofitted to meet today's needs. And how do we help them to get there? And then more importantly, bring that instructor along so you can see that a partnership is kind of naturally forming in that environment. And the result of that will be, I think, that's the time at which we take advantage of that preformed partnership and start to migrate that into a full-blown mentoring program internally in these businesses. Most of the trades that you talk to, they may have apprenticeship programs, but most of those apprenticeship programs, you're fully engaged. You're working in those businesses.
Mm-hmm.
You may be going back, like in our case, to take ICAR training through that process. And there's steps involved that's far more formal than what we have today. But most of those individuals are on a pay scale that's far different than what happens in our shops. So the shops really aren't ready today. And when we had True to Form, if you think about this, we tried some things that worked really, really well for us, where we would open a store brand new, ground up, and in that new location, we would put an A-tech and possibly two A-techs, a painter or a refinished tech. We would have a disassembly and reassembly person. We would, and most of those lower level positions, that B and C level, came right out of the school. And in many cases, they were still in school. And we had the highest gross margins because we had one A-tech. We had the most, and I think, success around building those individuals. The problem we had is what happened when it was time for them to go to the next level and you moved them out of that store and put them someplace else. They were lost when they got into that store. They knew enough, but not enough to be successful. And that's a lot of the problems we have today. Is some of these larger businesses are spending millions trying to figure this out. But once they dump them in that location, especially if they trained them in one spot and then dumped them in another, and in many cases, that's in, from one state to another state. If you look at the military transitions that we've been through and some of the stuff we've done with the military, You train them up, they're great. They've got the discipline. They have everything they need. And then move them 1,500 miles away into another state where they have no network, nothing around them, and expect them to compete in that shop they're going into, where they still, they've only been in training for 8 weeks, 12 weeks, whatever that time frame is. Mm-hmm. We know that it takes several years to get to the point that you can be let alone, and not, you know, especially with today's technology. So, you know, all those things, it's a big, big step. And I'm not sure that we're the right ones to be involved with that. That's another big challenge of ours. So do you really, you know, should CREF be the one that really brings accountability to the overall process? Or is there going to be more of a maturation process that occurs where we all start to understand these challenges and working much more closely together, get rid of some of the splinters, if you would, and really start to shape this piece of wood into something that's beautiful? And I'm hoping that that's where we'll end up, but it's going to take time. Mm-hmm. Right now is the worst time because, let's face it, too many of the schools are not even open today. So if they're open, they're certainly not working on the lab side. They're probably taking ICAR classes. So
the COVID situation has impacted so many things up and down the industry, and changes that are going to be affecting us long after that we're all vaccinated and it ceases to become the issue that it is now.
Yep.
But can you tell me a little bit of how seriously has COVID affected your efforts in CREF? I mean, I imagine it's been pretty tough.
It was devastating. So we were at 15 million and suddenly, all of a sudden, we fell from 15 million in support for these schools down to probably this year when it's all said and done, it'll be 2 to 3 million.
Wow.
Now, a good portion over and above that will be our in-kind gifts, which are very important for the schools. These are the things they need to keep their doors open in many cases. But the fact that we went from 7 staffers, and that could have been doubled, depending upon, especially with what I just described to you, is in order to get to that point and do all those things that we were doing, which was very labor-intensive. We depended upon the volunteers to support this, but we had to be the ones that put it together, right? That built the program and then went out and then monitored and stayed involved in that until we could let it go. You do a career fair. When you start doing career fairs, it's just us. And then eventually you get the volunteers involved. You get the regional folks involved. And it morphs into something very large and much, much bigger. So our first career fairs, we had 60 or 70 students show up. Today, we have 500 students show up to a career fair. Mm-hmm. We do that 20 times a year. You can do the math. We're starting to make a difference. But COVID put us in a position where we really didn't have those resources to be able to continue down that line. Mm-hmm. What we're looking at today, and you know, maybe if there's a silver lining, is, okay, we've done all this stuff. now it's time for us to step back, take a fresh piece of paper, which is where we started here, mm-hmm. and look at what was good, what worked, what didn't, what do we do differently? So we are in the process of building that 3 to 5 year plan. It'll probably end up a 5 year plan, but the real focus will be over the next 3 because of the bumps in the road as we get down that path. You know, you've heard this analogy of the bends in the river, where you can only plan far enough to get around that next bend. You don't know what's next. What you do want to know is there's no waterfall at the end of that last bend. And we want to use this wisely. I think we've been doing that. I think we had folks that we were using that I don't want to use the term we were experimenting, but part, you know, we had true pilots running. We did the top tech competition. Mm-hmm. And I think that worked beautifully when we brought 12 different groups in from across the country. And it was an apprentice or a helper, if you would, entry level, that had to be on a job, that was on the job, but no more than 1 year. Mm-hmm. And we brought that individual in with a technician, the tech that they worked with. And we had competition for those 12 teams to do 4 different phases of the repair. And I have to tell you, it was one of the most rewarding things that we've done. And we were hell-bent on moving that into doing that 4 or 5 times, you know, in different markets. You think about the pilots I mentioned and how we would use those pilots and the success of those organizations to learn from that. All that was part of the methodology to get where we were trying to go. So what I think has been confusing now is we had to step back. But the good news is we can take a good look at it, say what worked, what didn't, what can we do better? And now it's time to really lay that out and have a true roadmap for the future. So I think, you know, one thing that's good about getting old, Tony, is my patience level has grown substantially on some levels. So, I mean, I understand that this is a journey, and I hate to use that because it's overused. But it truly is the beginning. If we get to the middle, we'll know at least where we're going. If this group that's coming in behind me can get us to the middle, I'll be the happiest guy in the world. Because that's, if I leave this world knowing that we put these schools in a better place, and life is a journey, that's for damn sure. And if you look at it with some open-mindedness and enjoy it along the way, great things happen. So the only sad part about this is that I wanted to finish it. I wanted us to get to a point that we really had a true apprenticeship type program for the industry. I realize that it's a much bigger challenge, but I know that we're going down the path in the manner that which we were meant to be. So,
yeah, you have certainly made a difference. And, you know, it's always a work in progress. I don't think the job is ever done.
Nope.
You've seen so much, and being able to pass along some of that knowledge, which is something you've freely done throughout your career, I think is really what moves us forward.
Yep.
And your time with CREF has been well spent. You've made a difference. You've moved the ball down the field, as they say. You're going to be missed, I'm sure. I understand the board is now looking for your replacement, right?
Yes.
But you're going to be sticking around. You're not going anywhere, right?
Well, I don't know what it means yet.
Well, Clark, it's good to know you're still going to be involved at some level. And if I know you, you're going to be involved more than you probably think you are going forward. It sounds like you've got a plan, and it sounds like the work you've started will continue, and with your help. And I think it's something the industry sorely needs. Congratulations on the grandchild.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. We're beyond excited about Miller.
That is usually one of those seminal moments that does make a change. And now you have a grandchild to spoil. So that will take up a lot of your time, I'm sure.
That and my 46 nieces and nephews. So I got plenty. Now I got one of my own. So this is perfect. Thanks, buddy.
Well, family is everything.
Yep.
Well, Clark, it has been a pleasure talking with you as always. And we've been talking with Clark Pluchinski, the retiring executive director of the Collision Repair Education Foundation, and certainly one of the icons in the collision repair industry. Clark, good luck in whatever's coming next. Again, you have made a difference, and I'm delighted that you were able to take some time to talk with me today. Thank you.
Tony, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for what you do every day as well, and that continue to do for this industry.
Well, I appreciate that, and we'll be looking forward to some more great things from CREF.
Thank you.
Take care of yourself, brother.
Okay. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. If you're brand new to the ASA podcast, or if you've been here before, I encourage you to subscribe so you won't miss some of the great things we have coming up in our future episodes. Just hit the subscribe button wherever you're listening and you'll be good to go. If you enjoy our podcast and find our content valuable, make sure to leave a rating and review wherever you are listening to this. And if you're an automotive service facility shop owner listening to this podcast and you'd like to know more about ASA, I invite you to visit our website at asashop.org. I'm Tony Mala, and thanks for listening.